I'm Thomas Drantz, not Jamie Dodd. Coming to you live, it is Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. As you can perhaps tell, Jamie Dodd is no longer on this program, and Josh Elliott-Wolf, who is going to be filling in, is out sick. So I'll be flying solo today, which, you know, honestly, solo is a relative term. We've got the crossover right off the hop. We'll get to Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal shortly. We've got Jason Bukala at 1 p.m. We're going to have a great program with or without a co-host. So it goes. Of course, Canucks Talk is brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley. It's a great day for hockey. As you know, whenever I'm alone on the air, I do need your help. You can help me out by engaging with the program using the Dunbar Lumber text line. That's 650-650. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit Dunbar Lumber at one of their three locations or online at dunbarlumber.com. And of course, this program is coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec is Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? All right, I'm tired of the sound of my own voice already. Let's get right to the crossover. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Don, Rick, how are you guys doing? And are you returning your buggies?
Taylor's
I good. Am. He's not.
The odd. I got to change. I got to make a change.
I spotted a rogue buggy on my way here.
Bottle of water.
Yeah. So you've got to make a
that
change.
Was Rick.
A New Year's resolution for you, Rick?
I got to make a change. The buggies I save on. I shouldn't say every time, but most of the time. I'm getting ripped, and the Delaney's okay.
Most of the time, you leave them where your car is.
But I leave them on an island. I leave them on an island so they don't skate away or do whatever.
Roll away.
Roll away. I leave them on an island so they don't roll away. And I'm not the only one. There's always two or three other buggies on the island.
That doesn't make it right.
Nah, there's two or three other buggies, Don.
It's like I tell my kids, you don't worry about what other people are doing. What are you doing? What's right? What's wrong? Right, Thomas?
So, you know, one thing that's interesting is if you'd said you do it at Costco, I feel like everyone would have been like, yes, yeah. I also don't return my buggy at Costco. You know what I mean? Like grocery stores, everyone does it. But then you go to Costco and it's like the Wild West. It's like I'm back in Florida. No one's returning their buggies. No one returns their buggies in Florida, by the way. That's another thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Cultural
it's
thing.
A big
cultural differences.
In society, Thomas.
It's a big problem.
Well, you know, Thomas, we brought up the Costco buggy as well. Have you ever used a Costco buggy, went off the property for just a second, and the wheels locked?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Has that happened to you?
You know what? I had
That's
it happen.
That's embarrassing.
I had it happen to me not at Costco, but at No Frills. I was pushing, and it locked right as I tried to go out the front door because my car was parked literally right out front. And so I got stuck on the sliding doors, and they were, like, coming. I finally put my knees into it and just picked up the buggy to my car and then returned it. Not my proudest moment.
Where's the video? We need the security video.
Where's the video? Let's go.
The sliding door is me just panicking. Yeah, no, look, buggy decorum. You know, I hadn't thought about it at length until Rick brought it up today, but yeah, I got some thoughts. So, gentlemen, the Canucks have looked more like a buggy than a wagon at times this season.
Yes.
And as a result, you know, there's some reporting out there from Frank Saravalli on the Halford and Brough show, on the Brough and Rough program, but also on, you know, his daily face-off show about the Canucks maybe closing in on a deal for a defender. Rick, you hearing anything? And what are your thoughts on the potential that the Canucks get something done before the roster freezes for the holidays?
Well, I said on Monday they're very aggressive on the market. But here's the thing about the Christmas freeze. It's not that big of a deal among teams because not many games are played during it. The pressure isn't as huge to get something done before it, but what do we know about this regime? What do we know about this regime? Jim Rutherford likes to get his work done early. Zadorov was November 30th, Lindholm January 30th. They are looking for a top four defenseman and a winger. Are they looking for a winger, Thomas, in case things don't work out with Brock Besser? You got to protect yourselves here in case you have to move Besser if you can't extend him, and that is a possibility, although those two sides continue to chip away, and hopefully they get a deal done. One team told me this morning, good luck finding a top four defenseman right now, Thomas. Prices are high. Teams want prospects. Some teams don't want to make a trade because they still think they're in the playoffs. And so a lot of those high-priced UFAs are on teams that are not ready to sell yet because they still think they got a shot. Now, we know the Canucks like Bo and Byram. They also like Ivan Provorov. But do the Canucks acquire UFA players again, like Provorov, and lose them for nothing? Or are they interested in guys with term and guys who they can control, RFAs, even a guy with salary arb? As much as you hate to go to salary arb, you still control that situation. So if you're acquiring a UFA, I would assume the Canucks would like to extend as well, not lose them for nothing, like they did with Lindholm and Zadorov. Giving up a first and a second round draft pick and then losing the player is the worst case scenario. And that happened last year, right? They gave up first, a second, and then they lost both those guys.
A third too.
Lindholm, they were never going to get back. Never in a million years. That price tag was too high. But Zadorov, they tried. You know, they spent too much time on Gensel, and they went back to him, and they lost him. But I'm going to tell you, they can't be in a situation, Thomas, where they give up a first and a second, get a UFA, and he walks again. It just demoralizes the team. And then your farm team, what's your farm team going to look like in 2 or 3 years if you keep giving up first and seconds? You're going to have to fill it with Western Hockey League overagers, European free agents, and NCAA guys, and that's not the way to build a farm team.
Look at it as a unsuccessful last year because Lindholm and Zadorov helped get them a decent playoff drive. One win away from taking out a team that made it to the Stanley Cup final and were a win away themselves, the Oilers, from winning the Stanley Cup. So it's such a catch 22 is that long run, absolutely. Lindholm and Zadorov, especially Lindholm with the first rounder there. Yep. Does that pay off? Well, maybe not so much, but that was fun last spring, and it's been a long time since there has been fun associated with this organization.
I think it's
I would have wished they would have got one of them back. I wish, Thomas, they would have got one back. But to lose both guys to July 1st was not ideal.
Well, and it's one of those things where if, you know, lots of teams buy at the deadline and retain players. So the Boston Bruins have made a habit over their sort of sustained run of success, you know, Hampus Lindholm, Charlie Coyle, right? Like their deadline acquisitions are guys that they keep. They're using the deadline to shop long term. The Vegas Golden Knights have done the same. You know, so I mean what Rick was talking about with the term, I've been reporting this for a bit. Like I do think the Canucks have been focused on guys with serious term. Rick mentions the arbitration thing. That's an interesting one because the Canucks have acquired a couple of defenders in that situation. Hronek had arbitration rights, obviously, when he was acquired. Ethan Bear. And to some extent, a player with or a player in that those circumstances sometimes has their value restrained somewhat by how leery teams are of sort of administering that in the summer. And of course, just the lack of control that it sort of creates. So some interesting angles there overall. You know, the roster freeze more than anything, which kicks in Thursday midnight, so Friday morning. The thing I'm sort of curious about with it is, will the Canucks actually do something big before their midseason meetings? Because, Rick, you and I have been working behind the scenes covering this team. We often do a big collaborative report in early January or mid-January. And, you know, you think about like Kuzmenko talks, you think about Bo Horvat talks, and then the Bo Horvat trade happens at the end of January. You think about Elias Lindholm, that trade happens at the Canucks' midseason meetings while they're in Scottsdale. That brings Elias Lindholm to Vancouver. I mean, January has often been a key pivot point, not just for this team making trades, but also deciding who they're able to keep and who they're not able to keep. And for that reason alone, I'd be a little bit surprised by like a whopper deal this week. Not that I ever want to bet against Alvin and Rutherford making trades, but this week it's a little bit outside their MO. They do like to get their shopping early, but not typically this early.
Yeah. Although they did pick up Zadorov November 30th last year.
But that was in reaction to Susie.
Reminded me.
That was in reaction to the Soucy injury, right? So I'm just saying it's like, and at the end of the day, they were just reallocating Beauvillier's salary into their defense. That was more of a protective trade. That was in some ways smaller potatoes. The overall cost ended up being a third round pick. You know, in terms of the major stuff, I feel like they tend to get their business done in January and February.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that Bick said the trade was made on November 31st, last time I talked to him regarding this conversation. I just want to take a shot at Bick there, if you don't mind. But also, Thomas, do they really know what's going on this season, given all the, I'll call it turmoil and injuries and the situation with JT Miller? You know, Hironica is out. We just talked about him. Do they really know what they have? I think they're, you know, going to wait a bit, even with Hironica out, before they make a move. Do they really know what they've got this year? I'm not so sure. As much as people complain and people are down about what's gone on so far, despite what happened last time out, I just wonder what they really think of this team.
Yeah, I want to come back to something else you mentioned, Rick, because there's been increasing reporting from you, from my athletic colleague Pierre LeBrun, or our athletic colleague Pierre LeBrun, sort of discussing the idea of the Canucks being in the market for a winger. And I find this interesting because, you know, you'd think a right-handed faceoff or a right-handed centerman who can win faceoffs might be, you know, a more pressing need for the side. Are you surprised at all that a wing would emerge as sort of a subheader target for this club?
I was. And then I kind of asked the question around this morning. I said, you know, why are they looking for a winger? And, you know, then someone said to me, you know, maybe because, you know, this Brock Besser decision has got to be coming down soon. It's not going to be 9 months away. It's a few weeks away. And maybe, and I'm just, you know, spitballing here, maybe you got to protect yourselves in case, you know, you can't get a deal done with Besser and you might have to move him in case things don't work out with him. And look, a Besser deal, that Thomas, would it not look like prospects and high picks for you? Like, I mean, are you getting a... if you have to move Brock, are you getting a player of his equal value back, or are you going to go for prospects and picks? I mean, you know, so that's why I wonder if they're trying to get a winger.
Yeah. The other thing that is interesting to me, Rick, is we know that they kicked the tires on some offensive wingers, right-handed shooters on the trade market in the summer, considered making a big swing for another offensive piece. And they did sign Daniel Sprong, and I think partly the reason that they signed Daniel Sprong was to sort of take a little half swing, a check swing, as opposed to a home run cut in the summer, keep their powder dry to some extent. But Sprong didn't work out. He was traded months ago. And so I still wonder, like, do they feel like they maybe need another right-handed shooter, maybe for the power play, which we've seen them tinker with? You know, could this be an additive piece in addition to Besser? Like, not only do we have Besser, DeBrusk, Garland, Pugh Suter, if we play him on the wing, on and on, Sherwood, but do we want another right-handed shooter who's a top six guy? Do they feel like they need more offense? Because honestly, watching them play, I don't think that would be something I'd quibble with too significantly. If they were to say, hey, we felt we needed another attacking presence, I'd say, you know what? I agree.
Yeah, and you forgot another right-handed forward is, I know he's in Abbotsford, but Jonathan Lekaramaki as well. I'm with you. Like, get more offense, more entertainment, that sort of thing, absolutely the better. Their power play is interesting right now as well with
the split,
with Miller not being on the first unit and Garland being there and DeBrusk being there, which I guess is understandable given he leads the team in goals. That's pretty interesting. But adding another right shot winger, if the guy can put the puck in the net, like maybe Patrick Laine is doing in Montreal, not that he's available, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, Donnie and I talked about this on the show. How about getting, you know, Hoaglander going? You know, he hasn't scored in 20.
This is his favorite subject, by
anyways.
The way.
No,
it's a big
how about
one.
Getting Hoaglander going, because this time last year he had 9 goals. Now he's got 2. He hasn't scored in 23 or 24 games. And, you know, they signed him to extension 3x3. And immediately after signing to him an extension, the guy's gone. You know, he had 7 minutes the other night.
Yeah.
Like, we're back to 6-7 minutes again. And it's just mind-boggling what this has happened to this kid.
Yeah, and I just wonder, Rick too, and Thomas, when he signed that deal, when the Canucks agreed to that deal, it was just so movable. That was one of the things that first hit me. 3 years, three per, coming off a 24-goal season in which he scored all 24 goals at even strength. And you just knew that he wasn't Rick Tocchet's type of player, just listening to Rick Tocchet talk. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you know, the time was then to move him, because it sure doesn't look like it now. But to Rick's point, they're not playing him a whole lot.
And just to sign a guy, Thomas, to 3x3, and then for him to go immediately, you know, down to the fourth line and getting 7-6 minutes is just astonishing. Like, did the GM not ask the coach, is this a guy you can work with for the next 3 years? Like, because he does not look like, to me, he's a coach's, that's a fit with the coach. And yet you extend him, Don.
Or is there a chance, and I mean, Thomas, you can chime in. I've obviously can chime in. It's your show. What am I talking about here?
Well, it's our show. It's half mine, half yours.
There you go.
Yeah, it's some hybrid. Anyway.
It's your show, my show, Rick's show, and the chair show.
Yeah.
Interesting fourth shot here with the empty chair.
The empty chair.
And we appreciate that. But what are the chances are...
It's to represent Nils Höglander.
Exactly, yeah. And his recent production. But is there a chance, this is possible, that Rick Tocchet said, yes, let's do it. 24 goals, absolutely.
Yeah.
And his game's regressed. That he's just not the player he was last year. There is a possibility of that.
Yep. Well, something's wrong.
I liked seeing him give Höglander a shot again in the top six. I do think this club, it's incumbent on this club to create a ladder for Höglander to work his way back up the lineup. But let's just look at, I mean, the numbers don't lie in Hoaglander's case. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do, as the statistician who drowned in a lake with the average depth of a meter will tell you. But... or would have told you before he drowned. The first 10 games of the season, Höglander was over 15 minutes four times in 10 games, and all five of his points this season came in those games. He doesn't have a point since November 2nd. That's wild to me. And he's been under 10 minutes in all of the games since, in the 20 games since, an awful lot of times, like 7 or 8 times he's been under 10 minutes played. I mean... it started out so well. It got off track. There was that back check against Carolina that I look at as the moment where I got worried in real time. In real time, I was like, that's a bad back check. Tocchet's going to hate that. His role has never recovered. The team needs to, I mean, look, not just the team. It's incumbent on the player to earn his spot again, but it's also incumbent on the team to give him some shot of doing so. I liked that they did last week against St. Louis, but then, you know, that was one of those games. Can I ask you something, gentlemen? I'm curious to know if this is just me. Is it just me to steal one of Don's old bits? Is it just me, or can you tell if you're going? Can you tell which Canucks team you're going to get to see on any given night within the first 5 shifts of the game? Because I feel like I can. I feel like I watch 5 shifts of this team play, and I can tell you they're going to play suffocating defense. They're going to outwork the team. There's going to be no oxygen in the game. They're going to take a lead. They're going to hold the lead. They're going to win 2 or 3-0. Or, oh no, this is one of those parade of scoring chance nights. Do you feel like that when you watch this team play, or is it just me?
I think there's a lot of, I don't think it's just you. I think there's a lot of teams like that.
Mm.
But to your point, look at last game and what happened right off the very bat, right off the top. JT Miller driving the net from the left side. Outstanding scoring opportunity against Colorado. And that just set the tone. And that first period, which we haven't seen a lot of this year, was really good. They outshot Colorado. That hasn't happened a lot this year, or in the last little while at the very least. And they took the 1-0 lead on Sherwood's first goal. So I agree with you. You can tell right off the bat. I'm sure Tocchet feels the same way. You can tell right off the bat with this team and a lot of teams, they've got it. And it just seems to be because there's been so many bad starts that it's been punctuated this year. You really notice it because there have been so many bad first periods. But I'm with you. Like that first shift and that first play, you just knew there was something there, especially – that they had to be pissed off about what happened against Boston on Saturday.
So many times, 10 minutes into a game, they have one shot. I go to the Columbus game, 17-2 shots first period.
Yeah.
Right? Then they beat Florida, just an outstanding effort, and they come back and they get outshot by Boston 16-4 in the first period. It's you are correct. You can tell by the first 10 minutes. I don't know about the first five, Thomas, but usually at the 10-minute mark, you could tell these guys so many times they've got, like, literally one shot on goal, 10 minutes into a game.
You know, I think really frustrates Rick Tocchet this year compared to last year. And Thomas, you know this because you're in all the post-game scrums. Rick Tocchet talked last year so many times about there are times in the National Hockey League season, game to game, where you don't have it. For whatever reason, you've done your pregame routine, you've napped well, you've slept well, you've eaten well, and you just don't have your legs. But you have to fight through that. And they did that a lot last year. And to your point about, you know, things don't look good off the top and they fall down from there, they're not doing that as much this year. And I think that really frustrates Rick Tocchet, where you're just not there. You don't have it. That happens to every team, and the good ones fight through it. They did that last year. I don't see that as much this year.
Well, and I don't remember, we're almost at the Christmas break. I don't remember a Rick Tocchet interview that was terse, short, cranky, until probably after the All-Star break. We've had more than enough Rick Tocchet short, terse, cranky interviews.
There's only been a couple of them.
Nah, stop it, Don.
But in the last week.
There was the Pettersson thing.
They've all been in the last week.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, okay. But still. No, there was a couple before that, too. The inconsistency's got to be killing him because it wasn't there. But this year, you start camp, no Demko, no Joshua, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to Besser's concussion.
Miller.
Then you go to Miller. And the
Hronek.
Leave of absence. You go to Hronek. He's had more adversity this year than he ever had probably all of last year. Like, I'm sorry, but this guy has had no ifs, ands, or buts about it. He's had a much tougher time coaching this year than last year.
Yeah, when it comes to being cranky during the press conferences, or the post-game interviews especially, but we tackled this subject over the last week or so, Rick. I'm interesting to see what you think, Thomas. Back in the day, and I say that a lot on the show, and I'm 900 years old, and I realize that, you would get the assistant coaches talking. Yep. And I understand they want the same message from the head guy, and they're worried about mixed messages. But I just think every once in a while, in a market like Vancouver, where you are it in town, and you are constantly talking to the media pregame, pregame twice, postgame practices. That I think every once in a while, give the guy a break and have somebody else talk. Just not every day. Mike Yeo did it at the end of last year. I remember.
Yeah, when Tocchet had the flu.
I say once in a while. Give the guy a break every once in a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think it was those guys. I know people might not think about it. I know they're living a dream life. But Rick Tocchet works hard and it can wear on you. I just think every once in a while wouldn't be a bad idea to hear from an assistant coach.
That's how they do it in the NFL, where you've got the full week worth of availabilities. Yeah. And like on Wednesday, you'll have the offensive coordinator. On Thursday, you'll have the defensive coordinator. And then Friday, you get the head coach for their briefing. So they don't talk seven times before game day or what have you. You know, maybe it's something like game day, you hear from the coach twice, but on a practice day, you hear from, you know, the top assistant or a rotating cast or what have you. Or, I mean, I don't think that would be necessarily a problem for media, certainly. And I agree. I think, look, it's a demanding job to be the spokesperson and the metronome and the middle manager and the hockey tactician and the real time, you know, motivator and on and on. I mean, It's a lot for anybody in any market, and I don't know why I threw that in. I just didn't want to set myself off, but in any market, and so I think I think you know, organizing some breaks, I think that could be certainly a conversation for teams and media and the league.
Absolutely, especially in Canadian markets.
So gentlemen, we'll. Thank you for doing this. We'll take a sec, we'll take a beat, and we'll wait to see whether or not the Canucks trade for a guy with term or a rental whom they don't return to the port for everyone else to use at the grocery store.
Like the shopping cart.
Oh, man. Don't quit your day job.
Hey, and Thomas, hats off. Hats off to you. You're doing the show by yourself. I don't know what the rest of the employees are doing at 650 these days. But if we talk about having a tough job, people might not realize how tough that job is. What you're doing today is tough. Hats off to you.
Well, are you kidding? This guy could talk for 10 hours nonstop if you asked him to.
That's 100% true. And also, I promise, to keep it easy on myself, I will only give like 70% effort. You'll know within my first five shifts.
Yeah, well.
Thanks, boys. Be well.
Beautiful.
And that does it for the crossover. Rick Dhaliwal, Don Taylor, our good frenemies, our favorite segment of the week. That's in the books. We'll be back for an open segment on the other side. You're listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. And a happy Hard Rock Christmas to all our listeners. You're listening to Canucks Talk. I'm Thomas Drance, here for an open segment. Of course, Canucks Talk is brought to you by The Hockey Shop in Langley. Shop in store or online at thehockeyshop.com. Of course, you can use the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line while we're on the air. In fact, we've got an open segment, so I would especially appreciate your questions. Producer Lena will select the best ones. Text in 650-650. That's the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. And of course, I am coming to you live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? We got one question that I wanted to get into right off the bat, Lena, and then I'm going to kick this over to you to sift through the bag.
There's quite a few in here. So.
I know. People are firing away. There was a texter, and I can't find the name of the person because I've lost the text itself, but someone asked me what I think of the cranberry ginger ale that they sell during the holidays, and I want to give it my heartiest endorsement. It's one of those things like eggnog on the shelves that I look forward to every year. I buy a 24-pack.
Do you go sugar-free or do you go...
I always go sugar-free because I don't like sweet things that much, except chocolate. Chocolate's the one like really sweet thing that I like. Gummy candies or like even fruit. Like I like fruit. I eat fruit, but like it's not my favorite.
Mini fruit or regular size?
Regular size. Or honestly, I'm not a sizist when it comes to fruit. I'm a fruit enjoyer, but like to a limited extent because it's slightly too sweet for me.
What's your go-to fruit?
My go-to fruit is bananas. I love bananas. A little spoon of peanut butter. Eat some bananas with the peanut butter. Share it with my dog. That's a very regular thing for me. A common post-radio or pre-radio snack in my daily routine.
Have you tried the poppy cranberry?
I haven't tried the poppy cranberry. Is it good?
It is good.
Okay, I'll give that a shot. That sounds delightful. But yeah, no, mixed with a little bit of an alcoholic beverage. Big fan of that. There was another question. Someone asked, what do they do with the hats after a hat trick? Now, I don't know what they do in Vancouver.
I do.
Do you? Okay, Lena's going to tell us what they do in Vancouver, and then I'm going to tell a story.
So since I am also on the Canucks broadcast as a producer, there was one day I was walking through the Jim Robson gondola, and there was a security guy dragging a ginormous bag full of hats. And I asked him what they do with it. You can collect it after the game.
Mm.
In the lost and found, they'll have the whole bag, and you just sift through which one's yours. And then I believe after a few days, if it doesn't get claimed, it just gets donated.
Right. So when I was in Florida, there was a media member, I think it was Sports Illustrated, doing an article on what all 30 teams or 31 teams at the time did with the hats. And we were like trying to get back to them. And this sometimes happens with organizations. We were like, we don't actually have a plan for them. They sort of go in the lost and found. There's no set. So we built it. And it was much the same. 48 hours to claim the hat. if the hat is unclaimed, it gets donated to Goodwill. We like built that whole thing based off of a media request. We didn't have the answer at the time.
Would you go to a game with one of your non-favorite hats with the expectation that if there's a hat trick, I'm going to throw this thing? Because I don't want to wear a nice hat to a game and then have the expectation of throwing the hat.
So for Dmitry Filipovich's bachelor party last year, we went, you know, me, him, and 10 of his closest friends and family went to Denver for a sports weekend, okay? And we saw a Nuggets game on the Friday night. We had tickets to a Nuggets game on the Friday night and Nashville at Colorado on the Saturday. And that Nashville-Colorado game, by the way, ended up being 6-7. Like, could not have been a more entertaining game. You know, I think both McCarr and McKinnon had 4 points each. Like, it was such a sick game. The basketball game we actually had higher hopes for, it was T-Wolves versus Nuggets, and it was like a complete dog of a game. Like, by far the highlight was a DeAndre Jordan dunk. You know what I mean? Like, it was a lopsided affair. Anyway, I bought this Nuggets hat. I'm sure, you know, if you're watching our content, sometimes I was wearing it. It was this like denim dad hat, Nuggets hat, and I loved it. So we go out afterwards and I'm wearing this this hat at the club and I'm sort of taking it off, putting it in my pocket, and I lose it. I lose it at the club on the Friday night. The next day we go back to the arena to see the game and I'm like, you know what? I loved that hat so much, I'm just going to rebuy it. And so then I rebuy the hat and we're sitting in the crowd and Nathan McKinnon scores his second goal and everyone looks down at me and they're like, you're going to have to buy it a third time. Like, you have to throw it if he scores. And I was like, no, I'm not. But anyway, my point is, I think if you throw a hat at a hockey game, you have to be willing to say goodbye. That's my view. And that's been tested. All right. Let's get to the inbox, Lena.
We've got a lot of questions coming in about Bowen Byram. So, okay. I'm just going to group them together. One of them is, hey, Thomas, we've talked a lot about the idea of bringing Byram in, but what do you think of him as a player? Does he propose a strong long-term fit behind Hughes? And all the rest of them are just saying how you see him fit into the Canucks roster.
I mean, Bowen Byram's a really good player, high skilled. I mean, pretty good size, right? Like, he's not a small defender, but he is more on the puck moving side. Obviously a British Columbia kid, played his minor hockey or his major junior hockey for the Giants, so that would be a cool element. You know, I think he's a really good player, but the analogy that I'd throw out there would be like a Sergachev. I see sort of Sergachev upside, where he can kind of do everything. His value, I think, is a little bit more offensive than defensive. And I think ultimately, while he can probably do the job of a 1A defender in a pinch, I don't know that you're winning much if he's your 1A defender. Now, the Canucks aren't in the market for a 1A defender for the first time in franchise history, right? That's something that the Canucks have. And in fact, they have the best one around. Like, there's no one better than Quinn Hughes in the league right now. Do you remember, you know, not to get too much into this, but do you remember when the Eastern media used to get really mad at me for suggesting that Quinn Hughes was in a totally different stratosphere than Adam Fox? Not hearing much of that anymore. Just saying, not hearing much of that anymore. I also used to take a lot of guff for suggesting that McCarr and Hughes were close, and in fact that there was reasons to prefer Quinn Hughes. Not hearing a lot of that anymore either. Sorry, I just wanted to take a break and pat myself on the back briefly.
You pat yourself on the back?
Yeah, with the machine. Anyway, I worry a bit about Byram's defensive game. I worry that he's not, like, really a high-end play driver. Now, it's rare that you have a real play driver on defense anyway, but if you're a puck-moving type defender, and from an underlying perspective, which can be a little bit vacuous when it comes to analyzing defensive players, you're not even getting, like, the empty calorie, pushing the pace impact 5-on-5, that sets off some alarm bells for me, which is sort of why I dropped the Sergachev comp. Physically, skill-wise, all of that, I think he's one of those players that I worry maybe looks the part more than they actually help you win. And that's sort of one thing where I'm a little bit curious to see what the fit would be like. I think look, this team needs more push from the back end so badly that I think it would work. I think Byram's been the apple of their eye dating back to prior to the Casey Mittelstadt trade. Like, I think they loved him when he was in Colorado. I think they loved him when there were far greater durability concerns about him, given his history of head injuries. So, you know, the Canucks obviously really like this player. I'm a little less sold, but, you know, that's how it goes. I think he's like a he'd probably, if you slotted him in on a second pair behind Hronek and Hughes, I think it would be an upgrade for sure. But, you know, I just don't know. I don't know that you're talking about getting like a Cernak type. I feel like you're talking about getting like a Sergachev, like that next level down. Probably a three on an elite team.
All right, next one. A question I've had for a while. Why are so many hockey players left-hand shooters? Aren't most people right-handed? When I played a bit of pickup hockey, I was always a right-hander. Couldn't have imagined shooting left.
Well, don't most right-handers shoot left? Like, I shoot left.
I shoot right. I'm right-handed.
Oh, do you? See, I find that incredibly awkward. I find the right hand. Yeah, you know what? I don't have a good answer for it. I am a lefty shooter as a right-handed person. I would bat right I'd bat left in baseball. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It is interesting. Certainly I always figured that the reason for it, like, I think most right-handed people are lefty shooters. I think by and large, and that's why the right-handed shooters are less common. Just because left-handed people are also less common. So I think it's pretty normal for righties to shoot left, and I think that's the explanation. Yeah, power hand usually goes up top, says the text inbox, and I think that's correct. Yeah, most players have dominant hand at top of the stick. So there you go. That's exactly what I would have figured. What's next, Lena?
This one's kind of fun. This is from Spiritual Advisor. Drance, if you were abandoned on Christmas, but you could go to one of the Canucks players' homes for Christmas, who would it be? I'd probably choose the Myers family.
It's too difficult for me to think that way. You know what I mean? It's like the when you're in the room covering the team as a reporter, it becomes almost like I think the equivalent would be like seeing your students out in public as a teacher. You know what I mean? It's like a polite hello is like about all you have the appetite for. You know what I mean? So my answer would be nobody. Be totally honest with you. I
feel like the DeBrusks.
Yep, look, there's lots of people who Connor Garland, and you see all the shark themed Christmas decorations, right? I mean, that would be a highlight. But no, nobody. That would be my answer.
All right, do you think this team's actually interested in trading Petey?
So I've been thinking about this. I don't think so. I mean, they signed him 6 months ago to a 8-year contract. You know, I think that speaks far more loudly than anything else in terms of the commitment to him. One thing I would suggest, though, like, I'd be shocked by something in season. And I was thinking, trying to think through if there were any historical analogies. You know, one advantage we have, I think, in analyzing this team is that Rutherford has been doing this for 30 years. And so we've got a pretty lengthy track record of like, how does this hockey executive think through and react to various circumstances? And I was thinking through an analogy for what it looks like if a team that Rutherford's in charge of bumps into cultural issues that manifest themselves, not cultural issues in terms of like these guys don't get along, because I don't think that matters. Where I think it can matter, and I'm not saying that we're seeing this necessarily, but I worry that maybe it's a thing, is, you know, I talk about this club's inconsistency. I talk about their defensive game falling off largely because of the work rate. Like, I think where relationships matter in a locker room setting is if it interferes with the group's ability to compete for each other consistently. And I don't think we're there necessarily, but certainly I think we're on watch given what's been reported around this team and given what we're seeing on the ice. So if that persists, one thing I was considering or thinking about as an analogous situation that we've seen Rutherford handle in previous stops was in Pittsburgh. So his first season in Pittsburgh went really badly. And at the end of the season, during the draft, Rutherford dealt James Neal to the Nashville Predators for Patrick Hornqvist. And at the time, it was seen as a wildly lopsided deal because James Neal had come to Pittsburgh in what then was seen as a hugely lopsided deal for, I think it was like Alex Goligoski, right, from Dallas, and had promptly gone off, like nuke, scored 40 goals in his first Penguins season, you know, was a tremendous fit, like an every year 30-plus goal guy for the Penguins. And then in that 13-14 season, you know, he has 61 points in 59 games, right? He'd had 36 points in 40 games the previous year, 81 and 80. This was a star player who had great chemistry with Evgeny Malkin and was ripping it up year after year with the Penguins. And the trade for Patrick Hornqvist struck people as deeply unequal because in real time, because Hornqvist was not nearly as productive, even though he was in some ways more unique, right? I mean, Hornqvist wasn't even listed at 6 foot tall, but he was one of those like tank players, just like an absolute, just an absolute bowling ball of a human being, and was elite at the net front. But in contrast with Neal being a point per game guy, Hornqvist had 53 points in 76 games and 14 and 24 the year prior and 43 in 76 the year before. Like, these were different caliber of players. But Rutherford knew that he needed to change the mix, and he brought in Patrick Hornqvist, who, by the way, one of the most beloved teammates you'll find. Like, go talk to Barkov and Ekblad and some of those Florida Panthers guys, because Hornqvist came in right after I left, so I never worked with him. But man, to a man, everyone in that organization will tell you what a huge impact his veteran savvy, his just quality as a teammate and human being made in sort of helping that club get back on track and winning some President's Trophies and ultimately making it to Stanley Cup Finals in a row and then winning the second one. And so what are the lessons here? No in-season trade. Rutherford waited to see how it played out. He wasn't going to knee-jerk make an unequal deal. He was going to give it time and let and see sort of how it unfolded. Two, you know, the key discrepancy between them was Neal was a top of the lineup player and Hornqvist was seen as a second line guy, but that deficit was made up for by what Rutherford saw as, you know, the similarly disparate quality of the two as sort of teammates and team guys and glue guys within a team context. And so if this sort of plays out, if there's anything we can draw to predict future behavior from the past, sort of what I'd say is, if it's going to happen, it's not going to happen now, right? The team's almost surely going to give as much time as possible for everybody to get back on the same page and get back competing for one another as they absolutely possibly can. So forget having it done before the holiday break or the deadline. I would be shocked by anything impacting any of this Canucks core in season, right? Again, based on nothing beyond how Rutherford has handled this in the past. And then if it does happen, you know, I'd expect the caliber of the individual being brought back to be paramount. That said, Neal, even though he was a point per game winger and a 30 goal scorer consistently in Pittsburgh, not the same caliber as Pettersson or any of the three top skaters on the Canucks. So maybe it's not a straight line analogy that we can draw, but this was something I was sort of turning over in my head, just thinking about it and looking through past trades and just trying to figure out, like, how would Rutherford handle this if some of what's being talked about in the market and outside the market has validity to it and actually is something that may drive Canucks decision making. And I think there are a couple instructive things here, which is if you're making a trade to shake up the culture of a room or a team and it involves a star level performer, Rutherford waited even as things went pretty poorly in that first sort of Mike Johnston Pittsburgh Penguins season. He waited until the draft effectively before sort of pulling the plug on a core piece, and I would expect similar thinking to guide this club's approach here. What do you think of that, Lena?
Great job. I was sorry. I was sifting through all these questions here.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit. All right. How is Brock Besser seen by the market and league at large? Is he still seen as an empty calorie scorer, or is there an appreciation for his intelligence, versatility on power play, and 200-foot game?
Yeah, I don't think anyone would look at Brock Besser as a two-dimensional scorer. The size, the battle winning on the wall, the matchup role that he's regularly held down, the playmaking growth that he's shown. Here's one area that I think Brock Besser, for example, would have a lot of respect around the league, and in fact know that he does, because it's league people, it's people like scouts, people watching on tape, coaches that really recognize this. Brock Besser's work at the net front as a screener, both on the power play and at 5-on-5, I think has caught the attention of a lot of people, because it's a hard skill to be exceptional at. And it's hard skill to be exceptional at as a 220-pound guy who's also got a variety of other offensive tools. You know, this is a big-bodied forward at this point who can play a power forward type game. No one's describing him as a power forward, but he can do some of the attributes that people know you need to be able to do to win games. And then to cap it off, anyone who's been watching hockey knows that Brock Besser scored clutch goals in the playoffs. No one in the league will ever spit at that. Everyone loves to see clutch guys producing in the biggest moments. Besser has that in spades, given what he did at the trade deadline last season. I want to pull one that I came across, Lena, here from Keefe. How does Drance feel about the current Celebrini is better than Bedard narrative? So, look, I don't know if you saw Bedard versus the Winnipeg Jets last night, but go find the backhand goal that he scores to put the Sharks up 3-2 in that game. One of the coolest plays that I've seen all year. And don't just find the goal. Find the goal from behind the Winnipeg net. Because when you get that angle, you'll see the wheels turning for Celebrini. So he attacks downhill, left side half wall, okay? And as he gets low in the zone, he notes really quickly that Connor Hellebuck is transitioning into a post integration. And Celebrini never looks at the net again. He just clocks it. He clocks, okay, goalie is transitioning like this, and I know that a goaltender in, you know, the reverse VH is going to react this way if I pull across the slot. And then he guesses, and I'm using scare quotes here because there's no guessing here. This is just a guy operating at the absolute highest level of hockey thinking. He guesses that if he delays and hesitates just a little bit without ever looking at the net and puts the puck just so as Hellebuck transitions, that he's going to get at the very least a good scoring chance, maybe a scramble at the net front, but he's going to create a dangerous opportunity. And he hesitates just long enough, and I think it was Zetterlund or Toffoli, for the screener to get in place. He never looks at the net. It's a no-look backhand shot, but he clocked it because he knew what the goalie was going to do based on them getting into a post integration as he attacked downhill. He shoots the puck like a second and a half later, but he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was trying, right? The fact that it worked out perfectly, you know, there's some luck in that. There's some variance in that, whatever. But he knew exactly what he was doing. That is a player operating at a preposterously high level. And to be there 20 games into your NHL career, holy cow, that's exciting. That's beyond elite. So Bedard is Celebrini is a capital D dude in this league. And that's so fun for Sharks fans, for people who like watching Pacific Division hockey late at night, for everybody. For Vancouver hockey nationalists who want to see every Vancouver hockey prospect kill it. I'm not low on Bedard, though. Like, if you were to bet me the over-under on Bedard's point totals as a 23-year-old and set the number at 140.5, I would pretty confidently bet the over. I think Chicago's a mess. I think nobody looks good. I think when you're watching that team, it's very clear that systems and teammates are letting him down. I think when they've played him with guys like Foligno and Teravainen, he's at least had running mates. You know, I watch the Sharks play, and I feel like there's lots of minutes where it's like, at the very least, you've got guys like Toffoli or you know, defenders, even guys like Jan Ruda and Cody Ceci and Alexander Wenberg. Like, it feels like there's just a higher level. I think David Warsawski is a really good coach. So I think what you've got happening in San Jose looks a lot more NHL level, a lot more vibrant and sort of fun. Frankly, I think the vibes are good. I think that Celebrini's got guys like Eklund and Will Smith, guys who are like his age, already contributing, also forwards. And so I think I think he's got a far better and more healthy, more functional dynamic to work in than Bedard does. I think what Bedard's doing is running uphill, but I have zero doubt about sort of Bedard's upside here. I think Celebrini's shown us enough that his upside may be a little bit higher than I thought coming into the season, and I thought it was sky high. But I still look at Bedard as like the best bet to be the best bet among guys we don't currently consider one of the five best players on the planet to enter that realm. I still think Bedard's a better bet than Celebrini at the absolute like maximum high end sort of tier. And so that would be my view of it. But man, I love watching both players. I just hope that Bedard and the Chicago Blackhawks, like I hope specifically that the Chicago Blackhawks hire the right coach and bring in some fun talent to complement Bedard, because what we're watching right now is kind of dreck. All right, that's going to do it for this open segment of Canucks Talk. On the other side of the break, we've got our pal and yours, Jason Buchla, and then we'll open the whiteboard at 1:30. So stay tuned to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to this heroic episode of Canucks Talk, apparently. I'm Thomas Drance, your host, flying solo today. Of course, Canucks Talk is brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley. It's a great day for hockey with the Hockey Shop. Also, please feel free to ask me or our upcoming guest, Jason Buchla, any questions you may be interested in. 650-650, that's the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, Metro Vancouver's trusted source for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you, or online at dunbarlumber.com. And of course, I'm coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? Well, we're not going to wait any longer to bring in Books, our guy, Sportsnet. Well, he's on television, but also Sportsnet.ca's Jason Buchla. Books, how are you today?
Great, sir. I'm doing great, my friend. Solo ride for you today.
A solo ride for me today. I'm not straining under the weight of it at all. What do you mean? hey, Books, when are you heading to Ottawa?
I arrive on the morning of the 27th. So Canada's game against, I believe, Latvia that day. But hopefully I get up to Ottawa, weather permitting, in time for the afternoon games as well. But I'm there right till the end, 27th till the very end. Looking forward to it. As you know, it's always great, right? It's a great term. It's fun. It's interesting to see how the up-and-comers are performing on the big stage, high leverage. I always like seeing these guys in high leverage games. Tells you a lot.
What storyline, above all others, are you most interested in tracking at the World Juniors? I know I'm putting you on the spot, but I want you to isolate the one thing you're like most scout giddy about going into the tournament.
Well, because I've been involved in obviously the amateur side for so long and drafting sometimes at the top of the table, I'm interested to see the Hagans versus Schaefer versus Martone type of comparisons that come out of this event. Even the Eklund kid, Victor Eklund, playing for Sweden. So all the draft eligibles, there's a lot of young players in this event this year. As you know, it's a U-20 tournament, but mm-hmm. Gavin McKenna, you know, he's going to skate, it looks like, on Canada's top line. And so these are interesting bookmarks for me. On the Team Canada side, though, I'm interested as well to see what happens in net. I think Carter George is the guy for them. But as you know, you got to ride a hot hand. And if he faltered for some reason and you went to somebody else and it ended up being even Kovach, the goaltender from Brampton. If that happened, you know, then you got another draft eligible in the mix. So a lot of storylines that way, and we'll see how it goes. From the Canucks' point of view, I am interested to see how Sawyer Mineo plays. I think that, you know, I've got him penciled in as a third pairing kind of shutdown, two-way shutdown type of role with potentially somebody like Caden Price from the Kelowna Rockets. And, you know, he's come a long way, Sawyer Mineo, and this is a nice opportunity for him to further extend his development. So I'm interested to see how he plays. And I'm kind of going on here a little bit, but with Sweden, you know, for you guys as well, obviously, let's see what Tom Willander's all about. You know, let's see what he's is he going to be pushing the pace offensively? Is he going to be used in all situations? What's his role going to be? So there's going to be a lot to unpack.
Yeah, the Willander thing for me is what's going to be most interesting here, Books, because after a really hot offensive start to the season, the production has cooled a little bit over the course of the past 3-4 weeks. You know, we've talked about this a lot, but you know, the puck skills side of it to me has always left me wanting, as you know. I love the skating. I love the compete. I love the motor. Like, the tools are there. But using them in the service of actually pushing play, to me, I worry about, which to me sort of concerns me that, like, could you end up with, like, a new NHL Ian Cole type, right? Like, a guy who I'm pretty confident is going to play a long time in the NHL, but may end up being sort of best suited to being like a 4-5 as opposed to something higher end, depending on sort of where the offensive toolkit lands. So watching him in this tournament and watching sort of how Sweden uses him versus Axel Sandin Palicka, I think is going to be massively instructive.
Yeah, and, you know, make no mistake, like, Axel Sandin Palicka is a completely different player.
Yes.
He's a transitional D. He's a smaller body. He's an elite skater too, Drancer, as you know. This kid's really good. And
do you think he's fast enough though? Like, because for me, the skating,
small area quickness is fine. Yeah, open ice burst.
Does
it need transporting
it? Because I get worried. I always get worried about the Axel Sandin Palicka player type that you may end up with a Bockvist as opposed to a Hughes. Like, I feel like your skating has to be at such a preposterous level to be Quinn Hughes. And so many of these guys that get hyped up and, you know, even go early, and they probably should, given what their upside can be. You know, I sometimes wonder, like, are they actually fast enough to pull it off? Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and I think it's fair, you know, but think back to when you and I were in the same room together in Buffalo. We were going through our draft process, and I had the same concerns about Adam Fox. You know, and I'm looking at Fox, I'm thinking, like, is this guy going to be able to play? Because he was so cerebral, right? Like, so smart, pushes the pace his own way, but he's so crappy with the puck. Now, your concern is valid, because a guy like Sandin Palicka, he's not like Fox. He's not as crafty between the ears with the puck. He does rely on his small area escapes. And, you know, at his first World Juniors a couple of years ago, definitely got boxed out with the pace of the game. He would expose pucks and run out of time and space, if you will, to transition things. With the man advantage, no issues on the offensive blue line and making plays. But that's different, because you're not under duress quite as much, right? So, yeah, we'll see. You know, and that's where, you know, getting back to Willander for a second here, you know, for me as a pro, this is a secondary offensive guy at best. Like, I'm not needing him to be, you know, a 45, 50 point guy at the NHL level. What I do need him to do, though, is defend with purpose and, you know, use his legs to kill plays and then responsibly move pucks up ice, either on his own or clearly, you know, outlet it and maybe join as an extra layer. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes here. I'm not put off by his, you know, the college game. It goes in ebbs and flows sometimes with scores, especially defensemen, and I'm not put off by that. His compete's in place, Transfer. Like, I don't think you ever leave a game and saying to yourself, well, you know, I wish he could execute a few times better with the puck, but he also didn't really compete or kill plays. And I never leave a game thinking those things. So that's really positive for me.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think it's more about the upside, right? Like, at some point, if you're going to play top pair minutes, right? If you're going to play, if you're going to be a guy that can carry a second pair in the NHL, I mean, it's such a high bar, right? Like you have to be so good. And yeah. You know, I just worry if you don't have the puck skills to help a team score, if you're actually removing some offense from the table in terms of your on ice impact, you know, you tend to end up back on the third pair. You tend to be scripted out of games where your team's chasing, right? Like you end up playing less. And so that's sort of where I get concerned. Again, not real, like capital C, is this guy going to be a player? I'm very confident that he is, but could he end up having more of an Ian Cole type career, which, by the way, like you take from an 11th overall pick, right? This is a guy who's going to play 1,000 games in the NHL before it's all is said and done. So, but, you know, it's probably not what you're hoping to land when you're drafting 11th.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping for much more than that, too. Like, mm-hmm. That's no disrespect to Ian Cole, who's had a heck of a career. But, like, when Ian Cole went to Notre Dame to play NCAA hockey, trust me, there wasn't a lot going on there offensively. It was, and that's just kind of how Jeff Jackson plays at Notre Dame, like at the NCAA level, that group. They play really close to the vest, boring style. I hate to put it any other way, but that's what it is. So
yeah.
Ian Cole fit the mold there. Here's the thing, and I'm curious what your thought is, because I'm, you know how teams are built up the middle of the ice, and you think about, okay, you have your one up front, call it, you know, Barkov in the day when we drafted Barkov,
sure.
And then, you know, you go get a guy in the back end. Like, I'm of the belief nowadays that in an ideal situation, you have, if possible, a Quinn Hughes in the one and a Quinn Hughes light in the two. And, you know, start to build out rosters like that, because I find like teams are always, I think the Canucks are looking, we know the Canucks are looking for a top four guy right now who can move it and do some things. I'm curious if we shouldn't start drafting. Like, what's the harm of having, even if very possible, let's just dream for a second here, two Quinn Hughes on your roster and not worry about the fact that they're going to be going every other shift, because on special teams, you get to the power play, you're going to load it up anyways. It feels to me like we still project to get that really elite one on the back end, but the secondary guy, it's quite a drop off to there. And I'd like to see teams start drafting more aggressively on the back end to have two really elite offensive guys in your top two pairings.
I think it's really interesting, especially because we're seeing now not just that having, you know, sort of one puck mover. Like 5 years ago, if you were to ask me who is the optimal, the absolute best partner that you could ever give Quinn Hughes, I would have answered without hesitation, Books, Aaron Ekblad, right? Righty, skilled enough, can do some of the heavy lifting defensively, addresses some of the size concerns, you know, balances it out. And now I would tell you Adam Fox, right? Because we've seen with Harley and Heiskanen, right? We've seen with Quinn Hughes and Hronek. We've seen with Taves and Makar that, like, actually putting another puck mover with these elite puck movers gets them more touches. It amplifies sort of what they're doing. So, you know, I agree with you in part because can you imagine if a team ever is able to consolidate two of these guys and they work together on the same pair? Like, what would that even look like, right? So,
well,
I'm with you, man.
Yeah, and even if they're not working together at the same pair, at even strength all night long, I mean, it gives you a lot of flexibility, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Like, you can even split them up. Like, Erasmus Anderson, can you imagine him in a Canucks uniform? Or even a Mackenzie Weegar, for that matter.
Right.
I mean, these guys would complement Hughes, and when Hronek, so even when Hronek comes back, oh, my goodness, you know, you'd be loaded that way. It's just curious to me because we always talk about top six, we talk about top four, but I feel like the second pairing puck moving D is kind of like the stepsister, stepbrother to the top six forward, if you get my drift.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if we're missing something there and we can't be more aggressive and just how we build that out, because it seems like the middle six forward groups anymore, depending on the roster and how you build out your team, you know, there's some teams that can't score a lick in their bottom six, but there's some teams that they have nine that go, you know, so
for sure.
It's just curious all the way across the league. It's an interesting debate. You got to have the draft capital. You have to be landing in the right spot, or you got to do a hell of a job and get a guy in the right area in the draft. And then of course they cost money later on. So that's another discussion.
So to talk about the Canucks at the NHL level, one thing that's been weighing on me, that I've been weighing myself, but that also, I'm not going to lie to you, actually kind of bothers me when I think about analyzing this team, is of late, I feel like within the first five shifts, I can tell you what type of night it is for the Canucks. And, you know, maybe this is some recency bias because I saw them mail it in against St. Louis and then absolutely suffocate the Panthers and then get demolished by the Bruins while skating at 70% pace and then absolutely smother the Colorado Avalanche. And it's just like, in each game watching it, I could tell you within five shifts how engaged the team was. When you've got a team that's profiling like that or trending with that level of inconsistency, Books, how does that sort of impact how you view it? Do you think, like, how should I be working through this in terms of how to apply the club's inconsistency and occasional lack of work rate to what I think of them overall?
Yeah, it's. I wish I could just sit here and give you a concrete answer. I can guarantee that behind the scenes they've done everything, including you know, do we game day skate, or do you give the options for game day skate? Do we practice on our off days? All kinds of different things. Is it a fatigue factor? Is our video session too long? Like, I'm just spitballing some things here. Like, they will try and dissect all kinds of things, because I'm with you, man. Like, in the last couple of weeks, especially their first five, you call it the first five shifts. I'm always into this first 5 minutes of the game, starting on time. Like, I'm absolutely into it. And, you know, goalie hopefully gets a good touch, and it doesn't even have to be a save. Like, Demko could, hopefully he makes a big save in the first 5 minutes, he gets going. Or he steps out of the crease, he grabs it in the trapezoid, he makes a really great stick-to-stick outlet pass, they attack off the rush, they get a goal early. You know what I mean? Like, just getting yourself involved in the game somehow. And, it's a concern, and it's so much of a concern for me, because we're 30 games in, and soon we're going to be into Christmas and tracking towards the back half of the season. Come playoffs, Chancer, you got no room to not start on time. So when you have that as a 50-50 habit, that better break. And it's got to break. It's got to plane out to be on the positive side of the ledger. The weekend of games was absolutely puzzling to me. Like, to do what they did against Florida and Colorado, which are all three opponents were different, weren't they? Like, Florida can play heavy hard. They can track, but you know how they can wear you down. So, you know, they can do that. Boston, I don't even really know what the Boston Bruins are on any given night. They sometimes play fast, so sometimes don't. I don't think they're a dynamic outfit at all. And then, of course, Colorado. I mean, holy jumping. That New Jersey and Colorado, to me, like, when they're really going, that's high octane hockey, right? So the Canucks clearly know how to start on time and get it done, but it's curious that there's these anomalies, and they're not anomalies, aren't they? They're not anomalies.
Not at this point.
Too often.
Yeah.
They're too often now. So, yeah, I'm concerned about it. It's got to change.
This next slate of games is really fascinating.
Yeah, I didn't even give you an answer there because I didn't have one.
No.
How puzzled I am.
You know what?
I had no idea.
Just hearing you work through it, though, helps organize my thoughts. You know, like, I sometimes worry when I think these things that they're too negative, Books. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'm just being a jerk. And I should gut check it. So I wanted to gut check it with you. The upcoming slate of Canucks games to me is really fascinating, because you've got Utah tonight. You've got a back-to-back against Vegas tomorrow. And then you come back and welcome Travis Green, old friend Travis Green, and the Ottawa Senators on Saturday. And when I look at where we sit at this point, 30 games into the season, the Senators and the Utah Hockey Club, the unnamed Utah Hockey Club, stand out to me as being teams that I could see a path to them being much more imposing over the latter 50 games than they have been to this point. Like, those are teams to me that match the profile with, you know, young groups. Their 5-on-5 profiles look pretty good. When I watch them play, it looks like they can actually, you know, hit a level and skate opponents off the ice some nights. They play pretty disciplined. They play pretty structured. Like, there's a lot of things that I like about those teams' games. They haven't quite gotten the results yet, but I think they could. And I'm not saying they will. I'm saying they could be those, you know, young upstart teams that become teams to take really seriously in the second half. What are you seeing from Utah? What are you seeing from Ottawa? Do you share my, you know, optimism about their range of outcomes here?
Yeah, so starting with Utah, let's just talk about tonight's game. This is a huge game. You know, in the standing, it's a four-point game for
me.
You know, Canucks
me too.
Staring at the, it's just 37 points, and you know Utah's got 33. It's a big difference if this game ends in regulation, and these are the ones you got to start knocking off if I'm the Vancouver Canucks, because like I don't know if it's sustainable what LA is doing, but let's just assume, knowing what we know today, that it's sustainable. So now you got to start knocking off these teams that are in that hunt for, or hanging around, feeling good about themselves in the wild card hunt. And St. Louis has been relatively active, making some, you know, they're looking to improve their team. It appears they're interesting, right? St. Louis, you don't know which way they're going there, but they look like they want to get better. So it's, I'm not buying the Utah stock necessarily, because I'm still on prove it with them. When they streak, they might not score, or like there's different things there that, but right now the Canucks are hitting them at the best version of themselves. And guess what? Ottawa, they're going to be hitting them at the best version of themselves as well. Like the Ottawa Senators, this is as late in the season in recent memory that they've been this far over 500 and on the cusp of a wild card position, like forever. And obviously this is something that they've been building towards, and they need to take the step. The Ottawa Senators, there's no doubt about it. I have them making the playoffs. I had them as a wild card team. I think they catch Boston. There are a couple of games in hand on them, and you know, they're going in to play Calgary. We'll see what happens there. But these are not easy outs. And but we're at that time of the year anyways that there's so much parity in the league. Games are getting hard. Drancer, every night the games are going to get hard. And that's just the reality of it. So I hate to – like, you're going into Utah. It's still new there. The fan base has been pretty rabid. They love going to the games. It's an atmosphere. So I hate to – to just be repetitive here, but they better start on time tonight. And,
no doubt.
Because you want to take them out of the game early if you can.
And you want to get these 2 points, because Vegas on the second leg of a back-to-back is a tough, tough spot for this team. Books, thanks for helping me get through this solo 2 hours on the radio. We appreciate you. I guess, we won't have you next week. So Merry Christmas, happy holidays to you and the family, and enjoy your time in Ottawa.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Hopefully we'll talk to you there, and same to you and your family and all your listeners out there. Happy holidays to everybody. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Books. That's Jason Bukla from Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca. You're listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.